This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, October 9th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. Abu Zubaydah has been held incommunicado for well over a decade in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. His case has now gone before the U.S. Supreme Court. Cato's Julian Sanchez describes how broad and often bureaucratically self-interested assertions of state secrets privilege, which of course exists nowhere in the Constitution, means for the ability of our courts to do their best to deliver justice. This case has been going on for a very long time. Start with this. Who is Abu Zubaydah?
So Abu Zubaydah is a Guantanamo Bay detainee who has been, at this point, held by the U.S. for about 20 years. He was captured some 20 years ago, and at the time, the intelligence community believed that he was essentially the number three guy in Al-Qaeda, a top Osama bin Laden lieutenant. It has become increasingly clear that that is probably not true, that he was not necessarily a babe in the woods, but a fixer for various radical Islamists operating out of Pakistan, but not even necessarily a member of Al-Qaeda, but believing, as it appears falsely, that he was a very high-ranking Al-Qaeda lieutenant. He was captured by the United States and then subject to what was euphemistically termed enhanced interrogation, most people would call torture, at a series of black sites in Thailand and then Poland. This included being waterboarded at least 83 times, tapes that were so disturbing, apparently, even to the CIA personnel running the torture program, that they were destroyed in 2005. It was also subject to a number of other enhanced interrogation techniques, stress positions, sleep deprivation, physical assault. And he's had a habeas petition pending now for some, I think, more than a dozen years, has not been, of course, tried, and has already, I believe, been awarded a finding from the European Court of Human Rights some years ago that awarded him $100,000 in damage for the conduct he was subjected to. And the case before the Supreme Court now involves a prosecution in Poland itself. There's a prosecutor in Poland who is investigating the conduct that Polish officials were complicit in, of course, a potential violation, a very likely violation of European human rights law. And so Zubaydah's lawyers want to be able to depose a couple of CIA contractors who were involved in that interrogation and that torture, and so that testimony can be provided to the Polish legal system for their own investigation. And the United States government, despite the fact that essentially all of this is now on the public record and has been for many years, there is not any serious question of whether it's the case that he was held in these places and subject to torture. But still, you know, the government would like the testimony of people who were eyewitnesses to describe the nature of the treatment that he endured there. But the government is claiming that this is covered by the state secrets privilege. This is a privilege that is, you know, effectively a creation of the courts. It has no explicit constitutional textual basis, but effectively permits the government to often, in some cases, to entirely avoid litigation, even over constitutional questions, by claiming that information that is vital to national security or that would injure national security if disclosed would be implicated. And so the question now before the court, after the Ninth Circuit essentially refused to accept that argument in this case, said, look, you know, you have to be stretching the notion of deference to executive determinations here too far if you're claiming that something this widely known, you know, can't be disclosed to the point where it trumps the other equities involved. So the question before the court now is whether he can depose these contractors.
And the fact that the Ninth Circuit said what it said would sort of flies in the face of the general nature of courts to be extremely deferential almost anywhere that national security is asserted, at least credibly asserted.
That's right. And you know, the principle here, which on face is not unreasonable, is judges have no special competence in evaluating what the consequences of particular disclosures would be. So what would be the effect on national security of some particular piece of information becoming public? Well, you know, the courts are not trained in making that kind of assessment which is effectively a kind of counterintelligence assessment. And so they are, you know, to some extent, reasonably deferential to determinations by executive branch officials when they say our assessment is that this would be harmful to national security. The problem, of course, is that when that principle of deference is in place, it becomes, a great temptation to see that, well, the court is going to accept whatever our representation is. And so as long as we say national security harm, we can prevent, in this case, not even really a disclosure because the information is public, but we can prevent legal processes that we would prefer not occur. In this case, not even legal processes in the U.S., but overseas. It's actually interesting to note that if you listen to the oral arguments before the court in this case, the heart of the government's argument at this point is not really even that a harm would come from the disclosure. Because again, yes, you would be sort of, I suppose, officially confirming something that is formally not confirmed, but it's not a secret. There's not any serious question of whether these things happened. So their argument is not, well, somehow people learning about this would cause a harm. Rather, the argument is effectively, look, the United States has allies that it shares intelligence with, engages in various intelligence-related covert activities with, and we commit with them to protect those activities that we engage in jointly and protect, for example, the intelligence that they share with us. And you know, again, here you can make the reasonable argument. Look, if the UK is sharing intelligence with us and there is some information that, if disclosed, would not directly harm US national security, but would be bad for the UK, then it's in our security interest to protect that information because otherwise we compromise the intelligence sharing relationship. So there's a certain logic to that. But in a sense, right, it lacks a limiting principle because what they're effectively saying is, look, anything we sort of secretly engage in with an ally, now because we've made a commitment to them, becomes something covered by the state secret privilege, kind of regardless of the impact, the direct impact of the disclosure of that information. So if, you know, the United States and Sri Lanka engage in a joint program to torture puppies for amusement and no national security reason, but they've promised each other to keep this secret, then the puppy torture program, right, under this argument, is a vital state secret, not because the information itself is critical to national security, but because we've made this sort of diplomatic commitment. Which is of course a problem, right? It means effectively anything can become. Can fall within the aegis of state secrets protection as long as there's an understanding between two countries.
Yeah, the United States could make some pledge to another country. We will keep this information about this thing secret in order to maintain a relationship with you. And then the state secrets privilege could extend to, well, we didn't really want to offend them.
Right, exactly. In the abstract, the logic of this argument makes the state's secrets privilege a kind of Swiss Army knife that's applicable to anything, provided there is this kind of international agreement, and you can make this claim about the importance of protecting a commitment. And that seems obviously like that a bridge too far, even if there is some sort of force to some versions of this argument. So the kind of the pure intelligent sharing version has some logic to it. But without some limiting principle, what you're essentially saying is the government has the ability to make things state secrets important to national security, kind of at its discretion, even if the underlying information would not be. So in a way, and I think one of the judges during the oral argument made this observation themselves, that at some point, really, you are not, in a sense, talking about a state secret privilege anymore. The argument they're making, in some sense, is not about secrecy, because it's not a secret. It's an argument about protecting our allies from the consequences of cooperating with the United States, but that is not a recognized legal privilege. So they have to sort of shoehorn this security interest into the concept of state secrecy, even in the absence of actual secrecy.
So perhaps this is a dumb question, and for people who are hawks with respect to terrorism, they might think it's stupid. But the question is, why isn't Abu Zubaydah been let go or remanded to some other group's custody?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the justices actually was somewhat incredulous. I think Justice Gorsuch, at least one other, sort of posed the question, look, couldn't we avoid this whole tussle over whether CIA contractors can be deposed by just saying, well, Zubaydah himself can testify? It's not a state secret for him to testify about his own experience. The government can't claim that.
Justice Breyer.
But Justice Breyer, that's right. Justice Breyer and Justice Gorsuch sort of raised this question. And the answer was, well, look, you know, he's being held not incommunicado, but he's being held in Guantanamo Bay, and he's allowed to communicate, but subject to review of all his communications for disclosure of potential classified information. So, in effect, that's not really an option while he's in government custody. And so they asked, well, you know, why haven't you filed a habeas petition to see if he can be released to do this? And they said, look, we've had a habeas petition filed in D.C. for a dozen years with no action on it. It seems like contrary to the spirit of a habeas petition, if it can just sort of stall for a dozen years. You would think that either, the problem, of course, is you would think, look, to the extent that this guy is, in fact, guilty of something, even if he was not, in fact, a number three Al-Qaeda lieutenant, he could be tried. But, of course, to the extent any information obtained from him was obtained by torture, that would probably not be admissible in U.S. courts. It may not be clear how satisfactorily they can prove crimes under U.S. law that are directly traceable to him. But they still believe that he is dangerous. And they're not necessarily wrong about that. And so, someone who cannot at this point acceptably be released, which of course, again, is the problem is we've now created this, fortunately, sort of dwindling group of people who cannot be tried, but who the government asserts cannot be released, and essentially are likely to spend, they've already spent, frankly, half a lifetime in detention.
So, is this an opportunity for the Supreme Court to put some sort of guardrails on what the state secrets privilege covers and what it doesn't cover? Because as you maintain, the government here seems to be arguing that we don't want to explore the outer bounds of what state secrets can cover.
Yeah, and you saw in the exchange a kind of desire by a lot of the justices not to get involved in the substantive question. I mean, looking for ways around having to make the direct assessment, which I think at some level is probably not avoidable. I think it makes sense, again, to have a certain level of deference. But I think, you know, unless the state secrets privilege is just going to be a sort of all-purpose get-out-of-jail-free card, to some extent, they need to start defining, in broad terms, you know, what kinds of claims are not going to work, or at least are going to be subject to more scrutiny than others, and also, you know, to some extent, to weigh competing equities, what is the interest on the other side of the secret? You're saying, well, you're claiming, you know, on the one hand, some potential diminution of trust. Well, but what is the interest in, you know, for example, assisting another country in enforcing their own human rights laws? I think that's an additional equity. And again, to some extent, it is the court's role to at least in some cases and with some level of deference to make that kind of determination. You know, we now know that the original case that sort of launched the state secrets privilege is one where, you know, at least according to a lot of people who look back after the fact, it's a case involving the crash of a military plane that killed some of the people on board. And when the widow of one of the people killed attempted to sue, that suit was blocked under a claim of state secrecy. And when ultimately those papers were declassified many decades later, a lot of the people, at least, who looked at those documents said, it really does not seem like there was anything particularly vital here. I mean, there may have been, you know, something you could claim was of some value to not make public, that would give some very marginal advantage to someone to have some kind of detail, even about maybe what wasn't on the plane. But there, you know, there wasn't much there. There was nothing obviously of great weight to the point where you would block an otherwise legitimate lawsuit. So the kind of the origin story of the state secrets privilege is, I think, quite plausibly a case where, in fact, there was a very minimal security interest and a desire to avoid publicity and embarrassment for a classified program. And I think, you know, the court should bear that in mind when assessing these, because, you know, yes, information can threaten security if it's improperly disclosed, but letting governments keep information secret to protect themselves from embarrassment by uttering the magic word security, that's a security threat too.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.